Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Save big money now on new siding from LP SmartSide at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP SmartSide today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
And we are joined by Richard Blaze. You know him from Top Chef. You know him from his coif. You might very well know him if you're in Southern California from Ember and Rye, his new restaurant in Carlsbad, California. You will know him from a new podcast, Food Courts, starting next year. And Richard, we're thrilled to have you as always.
Good to be back. It's been way too long. You know, when you don't get a call back in a couple years, you always are a little concerned that you have upset someone, but I'm happy to be here now.
This is ridiculous, Kevin. The fact that Richard is saying we didn't want him back and that we had banned him from the show for the last 2 years. I feel like we've given you a shout out every single episode since you've been on, that you have been our favorite guest. So enough of that blasphemy.
Blasphemy, yes.
Oh, very smart. Actually, that's what is food? Food court sounds like a mall. I think you should go with blasphemy.
You know what? That is my wife's Twitter handle. And let's food court. We got to get you guys on it because it's two people who basically come in and debate over things that are very serious, like hot dogs versus hamburgers, mustard versus ketchup. Noodles versus Rice, which was a Gregory Gourdet and Melissa King episode that we did. So lots of fun. And then I am the judge, jury, and host of that show, and I get to make all those decisions. Lots of fun.
So you're not adjudicating or your verdict isn't your personal feelings about where you personally side. It's how well they presented their arguments.
That is correct, because of course I go in with some of my own strong opinions, and many times I am swayed to the other side in during the episode.
No one really prefers Manhattan clam chowder. Nobody.
I mean, listen, I'm not wearing my judge robe right now, so I would say I don't disagree with you. How about that?
Yeah. I mean, but I think it's one of the worst manufactured food court arguments ever, is that anyone actually prefers Manhattan clam chowder.
Yeah, that's the argument. It's not even like New England versus Manhattan. It's like, can we find anyone that prefers Manhattan? I agree. Right. I mean, that's just it.
We had a fun episode this week. We're thrilled to get your to just reconnect. And this is an interesting season. First of all, how would you, just kind of having been on set, how would you distinguish this season from the previous 17? What was, in terms of adjustments, not just the COVID stuff, which I think is relatively obvious, but just in terms of where is the show at this moment in time over the trajectory of its like two decade career? What is the defining essence of the show right now, 18 seasons in?
I mean, I think that, you know, you're seeing all of its iconic glory, right? Like, you know, you're sports guys. So like you're now sort of in Yankee Stadium looking in, you know, the monuments in center field. And in this season, yeah, some of the monuments are sitting at judge's table, you know? So I think that's, you know, with the, and not just because of the COVID, like you mentioned, but because you have some of my friends and colleagues and the alumni panel, I think that's what really sets this season up different. Not just the bubble, not just the fact that we had to, you know, fight really hard just to, you know, produce a season, but you get all of these, you know, Top Chef heroes and villains. I'm using myself as the villain here, in the table, on the table.
Yeah, because you've come back, been on the show as a contestant, and then you came back for All Stars and won that. And then you've been doing some judging. But this is every meal. Like, it seems like you're there every meal. And that sounds like, you know, when people talk about dream jobs, I kind of think being a judge on Top Chef is a dream job, because it's fun and you get to eat a shit ton of good food.
Yeah. I mean, it does not suck. I mean, it's easy to, not only that, then this season, you know, because of the moment we were in, right? Like, you're also getting to hang out with like people you truly admire and friends, and you're becoming friends. And I think, you know, as you're watching it as a viewer, I hope that you're sort of seeing that camaraderie, yeah, you know, become more real each and every episode, because we are in that bubble. And even just the debate that's happening on the show, now you have 5-6 people plus Tom, Padma, and Gail every week that is sort of adding into this, you know, the whole judging philosophy. I think it's a tougher season for the competitors because of that.
No, it is totally detectable, right? Like, it used to be, especially in the early seasons, like, hey, we're in this city, we need to assemble a judges table. Let's grab a chef from this part of town, a chef from this tradition. This person's local. Let's gather them. And it's not that there's no like chemistry at the dinner table, but there's no chemistry at the dinner table. And what's happened over 18 seasons is that, like, you guys now have been in this sort of extended family for 20 years. So like, it's now a table as a viewer where it's like, oh, I really, really like to be at that table. That's like, oh, that's dinner with Barack Obama and Joan Didion and, like, you know, the people you want to have dinner with. And there is definitely that quality now to the judges table, which is, it just looks like a dude is licking a plate, right? You have to be really comfortable to be at a table and you have to have a really fun time at a table to be totally unself-conscious about licking a plate in front of other people. So yeah, I totally agree with you. That's been really fun. It's just to have all of you guys. The show has now produced this several generations. So it's not just, oh, these three regulars and whoever happens to be in town and available to sit at a table. It is just sort of a further extension of kind of the show's inner circle.
Yeah, and then the more comfortable we get with each other, we already were going into the season, the more it becomes like your family's holiday table, right? Right. And you know your aunt and uncle are going to get into it if someone brings this up, or, you know, obviously all within food here, but like it gets hot sometimes with this sort of setup, because the guest judge, as you mentioned, they're also, you know, they're popping in, maybe it's one episode and it's a new thing to them. And it takes a lot of guts to sit up there on the judge's table and then argue with Tom Colicchio and Padma about something where now you're like, okay, no, I'm licking this plate. I'm ready to argue with, you know, my mentor, my hero, you know, the main hosts of this show, because now we're comfortable together.
Let's do some hindsight analysis. That's really the fun of this episode of our thing, which is just like, yeah, let's dish. I mean, it's a classic quick fire, right? Which is product placement, but actually there's some great sense, because camp, I mean, look, cream of mushroom soup is the ultimate American hack for about 17 different sort of good housekeeping dishes. And now these folks have to be really intelligent with it. So how do you approach like a Campbell's soup sort of quick fire if you're them? Like what are the do's and don'ts? Where are the sand traps in a Campbell's soup quick fire?
I mean, the sand trap is just sort of, you know, adding something to the soup, right? I think, and I'm, without having been on set for the quick fire, I'm not exactly sure what happened. The magic is when you sort of can reinterpret the you know, whatever in the can texturally, or make it something totally unique. So in full disclosure, I have done some work with Campbell's before. I have been in Campbell's headquarters before. Brilliant place. I mean, you have some truly like world-class chefs that work for these companies. And just to also be clear, I'm not on the Campbell's payroll right now. But when you take like, you know, something that I did in their kitchen was you take, you know, cream of chicken soup, which is like the ultimate sort of like umami flavor. And I just took it right out of the can cold and spread it on some toast. And like, that sounds probably disgusting to so many people listening to this, but it's like looking at what's in the can and not just throwing it on the stove, not just doing what the directions tell you to do. And it was great. It's like a pate. It's like, you know, it's like a rillette on a piece of toast. So that's the exciting part about this challenge, when you realize that there's something magic in that can, in that box, whatever it is.
That should be a challenge, is just like fancy toast, but it's actually just raw soup from straight out of the can.
I don't work for Campbell's soup either, but I was remembering where, like, you know, I think a pop critic once asked, you know, Warhol, you know, why he did the Campbell's soup. And he's like, I like soup. Like, the guy just liked Campbell. I mean, one of the great pop artists of the 20th century, dude liked Campbell's soup. And so he created what was ultimately one of the great artistic piece of iconography in history. So, it was very fun too, because Chris won this. I'm very happy that Chris won. And you made note of it. You made note of it, Richard, because he had just delivered clunkers in the previous episodes. And I've had a sneaking suspicion he's the answer to the question, who is the best chef who has underperformed in this competition? But he does it with a grill. I mean, what I love is that, like, he won it with the grilled cheese panzanella salad with tomato soup vinaigrette, right? Like, he probably selects the easiest concept. What do you want with soup? Grilled cheese. One person figured that out of 13 or 12, and he was the one.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, really, really smart. Without having tasted it, you know, it's just what I said. Like, he makes the soup into a vinaigrette, right? So he's totally changing. It's not a soup. Now I'm going to use this as a vinaigrette. And he connects it to like the nostalgia and food people want to eat, right? Like, that always works when you can hit those bells and whistles, like when you just like go right to the heart of the dish or the product. So really, really smart. Plus, can we just take a moment, just as a fan here, like, Chris has got a great voice. Like, you got to get Chris on a podcast. You got to get Chris to do some reads for you. He's just got like that, like, late night DJ voice. It's just amazing.
Tom, it's Lawrence Tanter at Staples Center. That is the voice that Chris has. The Lakers PA.
He comes out with a bang here after a clunker from the last episode. He did the Haitian dish. And then comes in hot with the grilled cheese. Gabe and Sarah finish in the top three. Shouts to Sarah, because as soon as they mentioned that they were doing a Campbell's soup competition quickfire, I immediately thought of my mom stroganoff, because she used to do like the cream of mushroom stroganoff, like straight out of the can, throw some ground beef in a skillet, and then that's it, right? Wasn't very inventive, but I was like, ooh, I wonder if someone's going to do a stroganoff. And here's Sarah, who comes in and just nails it. And I don't know, was there yogurt? Is it yogurt on this one? I don't know. She tends to do the yogurt thing.
Homemade spetzla was the baller move there, which is I'm going to make spetzla in 30 minutes.
She did a smoked stroganoff with spatzel. Right. So so then we got Gabe in the top three. We'll get to him in a second here. Shota did a chawanmushi that just did not congeal, did not work, and it kind of preceded, which was a really difficult episode with him. But I want to bring in this factoid, Richard. We do a lot of analytics on this show. We break down the Top Chef show not just as the aesthetics and the strategy. We want to bring in some numbers to see if, like, hey, some of the decisions by Magical Elves, the production company, are they actually showing their hand a little bit with how they construct the show. And last night on the episode, they did the phone call home, Richard. Like at the outset, the beginning of the episode, they did a phone call home, which I always thought portended a little bit of an elimination about to happen. Later in the episode, you get the emotions tugging at your heartstrings. Oh, I haven't seen my family in a while. Oh, my wife is sacrificing, or my husband, my boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it is, what they're doing at home. But no, Richard, according to TopChefStats.com, there have been 55 phone calls home in Top Chef history, and only 8 of those phone calls preceded an elimination. 15 of those phone calls ended with a victory at the elimination challenge. Mm. So the phone call at the beginning.
Wait, did you track this? This is Top Chef Stats. This is our friend at Top Chef Stats.
TopChefStats.com. Lynn at TopChefStats.com.
Oh, bless you, Lynn.
Every phone call that happened on Top Chef, and then tracked what happened later in that episode, because I think she had the hypothesis, which I did, which is, Gabe's going home today because he did the phone call home. And actually the flip is true, is that more often you see that person being winning the judges table, not getting eliminated. So that was fascinating to me. Richard, I know you were a judge on this episode. But do you have any aspirations to be a producer or to edit one of these episodes? Because I know you're a man of many talents. You're Draymond Green out there. You can do a whole lot on the basketball floor. Do you want to do like editing a Top Chef episode or being a magical elf?
First of all, yes. Thank you for the inspiration. Like, of course I want to. I would like to then, I'd like to edit, sort of direct an episode. That would be amazing. You know, I think. Thank you for giving me something else to chase up the hill here. Let me send an email. I won't get a response, but yeah, I would love to do it. But I'm more just like, I'm a numbers guy too. And like, thank you for bringing one day you're watching a baseball game. You're like, when did we start, looking at exit velocity or like whatever happened? And like this needs to be in the Top Chef world. Like, I want to see that stat like roll up when the phone call home is happening. Yes. Sort of like VH1 video, pop-up video. Let's do it. More yes. Numbers, more metrics, please.
I love it. And one of the things also, as an addendum to that, of the 55 phone calls home, Lynn found out that it does predict something, which is 46 of those 55 phone calls ended up with the chef going to the judges table. So they're not just giving you the phone call and then saying like, all right, we're done with that storyline. We're bringing it back and we're building into the judges table one way or the other. You're going to see that person at the end. Kevin, did you feel the same way? I know Gabe isn't on your fantasy team. He's on my team. But did you feel like, hey, phone call home. He's got his daughter, his kids, his three kids are watching Top Chef at home. They love Top Chef. And I was just getting a little worried. I was like, oh no, like they're doing a little bio on Gabe. Like this feels like this is ominous.
It's one of those things where even though I'm knee deep in Top Chef, this is what we do. This is what I love. I watch it with a partner who's only a casual fan, but has watched many other competition reality shows. And like Eric, the minute that phone call was over, Eric turned to me. He's like, oh, Gabe's going to win tonight. And I was like, no shit. Oh. Okay. And so this is one of those cases where I know too much, that I'm so deep into figuring out whether or not you can truly reduce mushroom soup to a reasonable sauce or whatever, that like the guy sitting next to me who's never operated a spatula in his life, but just can look at Gabe and say like, yeah, that dude's going to win tonight. And he was right, of course.
Did you have a phone call home on Top Chef?
Yeah, well, I was going to say like, you know, the stats are great, but then, you know, the behind the scenes is that like, you know, 90% of the contestants probably made a phone call home that week, you know? So like right. they have the arsenal to sort of pop in with, there should be a spinoff that's just Top Chef phone calls home, because there's, you know, months of footage of people just calling home. Have I ever made the phone call home? Was that the original question?
Well, like the, yeah. did, we're in an yeah. episode, did it air?
Yeah. I'm sure it did. Yeah. I mean, and then it's sort of one of those things, you make the phone call, and then if it ends up, you know, being a part of the storyline, maybe it slides in there. But I will say this, you're sort of, you know, you kind of request to make the phone call home most of the time. Right. So you're like, hey, I really need to reach out to my family. I need to reach out to my significant other, whatever it is. And then you're sort of like, you know, granted the permission to make that call. I would say, and my wife is within earshot of me right here, I didn't really want to be connected to the real world. Like, I needed to be locked into the game. Like, I didn't want to, you know, grab my cell phone at halftime, so to speak, and, you know, see what was going on back home. I needed to be locked in into the bubble as a competitor, so that I didn't let those things interfere with me.
Right. This is the social media harsh. Blackout LeBron does every playoff.
Does he?
Well, Zero Dark 30-23. Yeah.
Yeah.
LeBron won't go on social media during the playoffs. And it turns out it does pretty well for him.
Yeah, that works. Like my name's just never, ever been mentioned with LeBron in the same sentence or two. So like, I'm feeling pretty good about today.
That's it. So the elimination's an interesting one. Is you must work with fruit. We are not going to furnish you, but make a savory dish. And by the way, like the thing that would have freaked me out is no shallots. Like, if I was thinking, okay, you do some like fruity onion marmalade-y kind of things and like the challenge is you will pick this fruit. You will suffer shock from your bee stings, and you will create a dish that is entirely savory, but is, you know, with no vegetables and all fruit. Richard, there seems to me these kind of contradictions of Top Chef theory. On one hand, it's cook your food. You got to cook your food. Stay true to yourself. On the other hand, generally speaking, I think most eliminations occur because the person didn't fundamentally understand the limitations of the challenge, right? They didn't appreciate that, you know, you didn't have the infrastructure in that non-kitchen to pull off that particular technique. Or you didn't understand that what the judges wanted, this was an X challenge and you didn't highlight X. So I always feel like there's this tension in the show where everyone is told just to cook their food, but when they cook their food, irrespective of the parameters of the challenge, they get dinged. And so like that balance is a real thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to me, the key is always trying to like really, really focus on what the challenge is and then find whatever's within your skill set or arsenal to make your food the challenge, right? Like that's the whole game. The whole game is listening to the criteria of the challenge and then saying, do I already have something in my bag that sort of fits and or something that I could adapt to it? Like, to me, that's when it works. Like, and then the problem is you have to commit really, really early. Like when you start conceptualizing this, sometimes you only have a couple minutes depending on the challenge. Sometimes you might have overnight. But like when the clock starts, you have to have the plan A, B, and C, and you can't just be trying to figure it out on the fly. And sometimes just, you know, you can't come up with the idea, and you are kind of in an improv setting the whole way through, and you can see it in the dish when you're tasting it as a judge.
Okay.
Yeah, so go ahead, Tom.
I was just gonna say there was a beautiful backdrop, mountain in the back. It was a windy day. You're going into that episode and your hair isn't flying off your head. So was that a strategic move? Did you look at the weather report that day and think, I'm not going to have my hair sitting on the top of my head today?
You know, I very, very soon after that first time I walked out in that first quick fire, I think I was sort of wrangled. I got basically they were like, we got to put two guys on this guy right here. We got to double team Blaze's hair because we, if you leave him alone, it's just, you can't contain him. The hair could not be contained. So shout out to Hair, Makeup, and Wardrobe, which had to you wrestle with my hair, you know, each and every day. But yes, it was a little bit more conservative, let's say, for this episode.
Oh. Yeah. And the first dish you get out was Gabe's. And I've always wondered this is how often, and maybe Lynn can do this, the first dish you guys try is the winning dish. And it was the dates with the
it was a grilled chicken pork, and I had a ton of questions about this you, Richard. It's chicken pork with an orchard jus inspired by mole. Like, Richard, so first of all, it looks delicious. You made the point that, hey, fruit with gravy sounds weird and it's great. What did he mean when he said the plum is the protein? Because that's what he's building this like orchard jus, like that is like that. Yeah. That is what he's saying to us is. And I didn't understand what that meant. I mean, clearly the results were amazing, but like that was
sure.
that was the MVP move. This
yeah. Episode. I mean, he's, you know, again, you're looking for, again, that connection texturally to meat in this case, right? Because this is a very, very savory dish. And, you know, I might have done, as in, maybe someone did, like a fruit sashimi where you're like, oh, the flesh of a mango right. is very similar to the flesh of tuna. So that's what I'm going for here, where fruit's mimicking protein. So, you know, that braised sort of meaty texture of the plum in this case, that's, you know, soaked up all of that savory sauce. That's what I think he means by this is the protein. This is the textural component that's
gotcha.
Replacing a protein.
Did you like that dish?
I have not seen the edit, but I struggled with that dish. Like if you're saying
yeah.
that I said it was, if I said it was weird, it's because this was one of those moments, like I talked about in the open, where I'm sitting there really trying to convince all of my friends and everyone that like, no, this dish is weird. It's fruit gravy, guys. Like, and I'm
I
the
can
weird
pick that up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I am, you know, definitely someone who's, you know, a creative, and like, it was a little weird to me. Was it inspiring and successful? Yes. But it probably, you know, wasn't my favorite dish of the night, me personally, which is a big part of this panel now, because whatever four people you get up there at the end, those four people, their opinions obviously are a little bit more important than the six other people who are not at judges' table. And then we have that whole dinner to sort of convince our friends that like, no, that's weird. It was delicious and inspiring. But yeah, for me, fruit gravy, still a little weird.
Yeah. The dish you seem to like, and I was very disappointed, not just because she's on my fantasy team and a recent acquisition. Dawn had the caramelized apple risotto with apple glazed duck. You were absolutely floored by the apple olive oil puree. It did not make the top three, which I thought was really curious because based on the edit, your effusive praise, I mean, she's just been cooking her ass off. It looked fantastic. She pulled off risotto, which should get you some sort of additional bonus in this damn show. But that was a dish.
Especially because it was multiple risottos, right? If I remember, there
yes.
was
okay. Avishar. Avishar did a poor Ohio Zoto. What was it, Kevin?
Sushi Rice with Ohio Oto. Which was just a fail because of the bacon and the cheddar. It was risotto designed to be a burger with sushi rice, but it was a failure of conception, a failure of execution. But Dawn's wasn't, and I imagine you would have had her in the top three.
Sounds right. And then also here's a stat for Top Chef. When two competitors cook the same dish, you know, what does that do to, you know, like, so you really, yeah. then you're judging risotto, not just by like, oh, I've been to Italy once and I've had this amazing risotto from this amazing Italian chef. Now you're literally judging the risotto, versus another competitor. So I think that changes it a lot. And then the puree, her olive oil, the apple puree, I'd never seen it before. So like anytime, like you truly see something you've never seen before, that's pretty special because we've eaten and cooked lots of food.
Yeah. Speaking of two guys cooking the same thing, one ending up on the top, one ending up on the bottom, Chris comes with his seared scallop with peach butter, smoked and seared plums, pickled apples, grapes, which prompts you to say, is this the same Chris? On the other end, Nelson's doing seared scallops. He with an apple béarnaise, an apple shallot relish, apparently just a ton of rosemary and sauteed pear. So there was a classic example. Because I find that seared scallop on this show is a great hack And someone who can, like, by the way, like someone who can do a great seared scallop, because you know what, like doing a great seared scallop isn't entirely difficult, but it does force you then to kind of, the accompaniments do become just an enormous factor. But like that was a case where two guys did the same thing. One was really good. One was really bad.
I mean, are we just, I know it's cliche at this point, but are we surprised that they're cooking risotto and scallops on Top Chef? Yes. Like these are two of the most class dishes that, you know, are trouble. Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's not hard to cook a good scallop. When you don't, it's really obvious, right? So yes. I think that's what happened with Nelson's dish. And Chris's dish, again, you're mentioning it. I haven't seen the episode, but I remember it exactly. And it's also, it was that good that I can remember that moment and that dish. And it had like Michelin restaurant vibes and like Thomas Keller vibes. And it was like small and compact and concise. And it was something that, you know, until that moment, I hadn't seen Chris produce that level of food.
You know, I wanted to bust out the stats because we're talking about risotto and you know it. Like it's the risotto curse, right? Topchefstats.com. Lynn says there's 7 eliminations for risotto on Top Chef, which is a little on the lower side than I thought it would be. The last two to do it, Bruce Coleman and Joe Flam, both got eliminated for a risotto in Top Chef Colorado. I think Joe Flam did like a cauliflower risotto, which was interesting. John from Top Chef Seattle also got eliminated for doing a risotto. Why do they keep doing it, Richard? Is it because for some reason it's just like in these competitions, risotto just like flies to your brain and you can't quit it?
I think sometimes like you see it, you grab it and you go. It's sort of that commitment that I talked about. Like you just, you know, you don't know what you're going to do. Oh, I'm going to grab a bag of Carnaroli rice and you never know, right? But what I'm surprised about, like they should, if I was going to compete in season 19 or whatever's next, first of all, I'm going to this website that you're mentioning and I'm looking at all these stats. I'm watching every episode. I'm watching every episode of the show to, you know, to see, oh, they're always at Whole Foods. I'm going to map out a Whole Foods. I'm just surprised that like there is pregame. There is like a preseason when you get the call to be on the show. So it's more just
there are
shocking.
Big stakes than, here. Big stakes on, yeah, on the line. Yeah, come on.
Your whole career, basically. Right. So, yes.
Top Chef Stats is going to, you're going to lose 2 hours of your life. It's absolutely fantastic. Byron did pasta, was really concerned for him. I mean, because that stuff's flapping in the wind. I think pasta, it's a little bit of an extension of risotto. I think there are chefs who can absolutely crush pasta on the show. It does seem to me, it is self-generated trouble often. And he kind of pulled it off what was characterized as a deconstructed cheese plate pasta, which is bizarro to me. Because I also don't associate blue cheese with pasta very often.
Neither do I. And again, I remember this dish pretty vividly and the conversation that ensued because of the fact that like you don't see blue cheese in pasta dishes. I think there might have been red wine in it too, right? Like if I remember, or
yeah, Pinot. Yeah, reduction.
I mean, he made pasta. Like it's one of those things. Like you pull it off, and like you know, you hope for a high middle, right? I think the issue with pasta is like, are you ever doing anything that's like, wow, this is going to be like a winning dish, right? But making pasta outside, I think he made his own dough. I'm sure he did because it was a stuffed pasta. That's impressive. So like, you know, the technical skill is there, especially when you're outside.
Richard, I want to know, you talk a lot about convincing others at the judges or at the table. Are you... when you're pre-gaming, getting ready for the game, getting your warm-ups on for the show, are you thinking, I got to make a comment that is going to make the edit? Or are you thinking, I want to build consensus at the table and win them over?
Yeah, no, everyone's different. You know, obviously I'm a nerd and I do like to prepare for things and you guys are writers and I, you're never like loading up a line, right? Like you're never like, hey, I know I'm going to say this in this episode. But if you're smart, you know that eventually something's going to need salt. Eventually something's going to need acidity, right? Like something's going to be messy on the plate or whatever. And, you know, you are certainly thinking about different ways to say that this thing needs salt, this thing needs acidity. And then it's just improv and you're in the moment. And I'm never trying to win someone over, but in a table like that now, especially as all of the other alumni judges get more familiar with, you know, being on set, you have 12 people talking about food And as you know, you're not going to make the cut if you say the same thing the last eight people said. So yeah. As people are, and you literally going down the line. So if you're the 12th person to talk, you're like, oh, well, okay, well, Dale said it needed salt, so I can't say that. This person said this, this person said that. And, you know, as you know, you never can be like, I just want to echo what that person says, because that'll never make,
right,
you know,
exactly.
It's tough. It is tough when you got 15 people talking about the food.
But it can generate some real hot take culture, right? Because invariably, if everyone has said everything, you have to come in with, wow, this tasted, you know, this tasted like it came out of a cat's rectum or whatever it is. Like, you have to kind of edgelord it a little bit. And that's dangerous.
And like, that is dangerous. And luckily enough, I've judged, you know, many different shows, and I've been around those types of judges. And like, it just, it doesn't work, because, you know, eventually, right, I think the viewer gets that, okay, this is, you're just taking the other side of this always. But any good judge, you do, you know, I mean, for anyone who wants the behind the scenes, like, you want to be able to talk about the goods and the bads of every single, you know, here's something positive, here's something negative about this dish. You know, and hopefully every dish has at least something that's positive.
So Gabriel did something I thought that was really risky, because I'm watching, you know, if you recall, Gabriel had the trio of oysters, one peach, one green apple, one plum.
Yeah.
So A, I'm thinking it's a hot day. How many times have we freaking seen this? Someone who tries to serve chilled seafood on a hot day outside. This is madness. And then it's sort of like he gave us, I could almost imagine the Tom Colicchio. He gave us three oysters. Three oysters. One of, you know, like everyone else is preparing sort of set pieces, and yet he pulled it off. And you guys loved that dish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. And again, I remember it like it was yesterday, and delicious. I probably would have ended up doing a crudo myself. So I thought that was smart. It's always challenging. There's another stat to figure out, like when someone does a duo or trio. You know, my banked judge line is always, you gave us two more things to critique instead of just one, right. You know? So I think that can be challenging, but I thought that was smart and a great way to use fruits in the mignonette and the toppings for this oysters. I like the dish a lot.
All right, Kiki.
Yeah,
She didn't cook her chicken, and you're cutting that thing open. And what do you see, Richard?
You see the translucent chicken and you put it on your fork, and you kind of hold it up in front of you so you know that a camera can come over there and grab it. And, you know, you're thinking, why in the world didn't you just cook two extra pieces of chicken? Because here's what you do. You cook more than you need on the show, and you cut everything open, and you eat one thing that you've made so that you can see, okay, look, the chicken's cooked, because you'll see a lot of sliced meat on Top Chef, because that way you can slice it and see the temperature of the meat so that you're not just like you don't know what the judges are going to get. So I was surprised that like she just didn't, you know, put herself in that, you know, where she tested it before she sent it out. And, you know, one of those things, you know, I think I probably said, or if it didn't make the cut, like, you know, you get raw chicken in a restaurant, you send it back. It's not like I didn't like it. It's like you return it to the kitchen. And if you get a dish sent back to the kitchen on Top Chef, you know, that's trouble.
Of course, except me, Tom. Richard, I have this thing, which is I love really undercooked chicken, like chicken shishi. I'm serious. I eat it at my counter. I confess. I just think everything else is good tartare. So is chicken. It just happens to be, you know, a death-defying experience. But other than that, like I really love undercooked chicken. I'm just going to be straight about it.
Respect. See, like, we got to get you on the judges table.
I would not have sent her home. But yeah, that's an infrastructural one. Richard, what are you thinking? Like one little outdoor fryer. Like to me, I'm just sort of, and you had said it, right? Like the competition almost begged for someone to do a good smoked protein with like a smoked chicken with or a grilled chicken with a barbecue sauce based with, you know, stone fruits, right? Like that's such a no-brainer. And that was one of the head shakers to me, is I don't understand chefs who don't just kind of look at the infrastructure of the challenge and say, all right, the following methods are off the table, literally, because I'm not going to get anything on the table.
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised that not, you know, too many chefs took advantage of the wood burning grill that was out there, the charcoal grill for sure. And took a little bit more, you know, inspiration from the moment, whether it was, you know, using the leaves and branches and, you know, even presentation wise. So yeah, I think some of that was, left out. Like you have to be inspired by the actual moment, by the tools and the ingredients, and you know, the equipment that's around you. So some of that was lacking for sure.
Although then again, there's also this thing where how many times have we seen chefs get screwed by a grill that doesn't fire the right way or is uneven and it's not their grill? I mean, I guess, you know, hindsight's a duty, but I just like grills are also one of those things that have just doomed many chefs.
Hey, Richard, thank you so much for joining us here. And we're going to get you back on. It's going to be way less than 2 years.
Yes, guys. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me back. I'm a big fan, so I can't wait to listen to the rest of this episode and everyone here thereafter.
You got it.
Bye, guys.
That was Richard Blaze. Tom, always a thrill having Richard on. He sort of, he gets the show. He gets the show, Tom.
Yeah, and I love that he's a numbers guy. I didn't know this about him. I don't know why, but I kind of think that there's like two sides of your brain as a chef and as an artist like himself and as the personality. I just didn't see him as being kind of the empirical type.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun to sort of game this out with, because there's the show within the show, which is the judges are actually, some of the guest judges are competing amongst each other for sort of airtime. And there's so many different layers to an episode of Top Chef, right? Like there's this entire thing going on in the kitchen, the dynamic at the judges' table, like the producers. You and I have seen it on Restaurant Wars, so it's just always cool to get Richard's perspective. And of course, there's the competition, and this was a really interesting episode in terms of exposing strengths and weaknesses. What were your biggest takeaways from sort of the standings?
Yeah, I was surprised that, you know, Kiki went home. I was thinking that, look, she has been a mess all year or all season. She hasn't really figured out what she wants to do. Opening up this episode, she said, "I'm getting inside my own head." And it seemed like she was not built for Top Chef competition. And who knows, maybe this is, she's going to make a run here in Last Chance Kitchen. But what I'm seeing is someone who is an excellent, superb chef, executive chef back home outside of the competition, but just wasn't really cut out for Top Chef. It seemed like she was all over the place. And I traded her not because of that last week to you a couple of weeks ago, but seeing her get eliminated for the raw chicken, I was debating whether Avishar with the risotto curse would strike again and he'd go home, or Nelson with the heavy, cheesy sauce with the scallop. I thought any of those three would have gone home, but it was interesting to see that even though she had a couple good elements on the plate, Kiki goes home for serving raw chicken, which of course you would have thought was a feature, not a bug.
Right. No. And actually I had the exact same experience watching it with you, which is watching it as you did, because seeing those three contestants up at the, I actually thought it was going to be Avishar, right? In the spirit of, he didn't actually highlight the fruit. Right. Like the whole point of we are plopping you down in an orchard, like there are like swarms of bees and ladders to pick apples and you give us a burger risotto, a bacon cheddar risotto. Like this is not a Northern Italian challenge. This is not a bacon cheddar challenge. The apples merely barely detectable. It was a failure of execution, a failure of conception. Like, to me, that was sort of the biggest fail. But it goes back to the, hey, if you screw your protein, like raw meat is kind of one of those things where it's beyond just getting it hammered or slightly off, or my lamb was very blue. It was raw, and raw chicken. I am the only person on the known universe who actually likes raw chicken. Kiki can make me raw fried chicken is delicious. But yeah, and then I was like, Nelson, like hearing Padma's just absolute scorn for that dish. I could not eat that scallop dish. Like there's a certain kind of just disgust that Padma can articulate with absolute, like no modulation whatsoever, that is as damning and as soul crushing as anything. And that's what she did to Nelson. So there was this moment where I was certain it was Avishar. And then I heard Padma. I'm like, oh no, Nelson's going home. Like Padma gave it the, like, just the commentary of death.
Someone who didn't get in the bottom three, but did not have a good showing and made me feel better about trading down from the number one pick, Shota didn't have a great episode here, Kevin. Was there a changing of the guard here with Shota taking a little bit of a stumble here in this episode? Both the quickfire and in the elimination challenge didn't really place in the top half of the competition. And I don't know if this was something that worried you, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, this does worry me in the sense that I just honestly can't recall a contestant in recent years, the possible exception of Gregory, where I just felt like this is an autopilot contestant. There's not going to be a technical fail, right? There's not like, yeah, he'll in the middle, maybe certain challenges don't accentuate his strengths, but hey, there is never anything other than a upper middle finish for this guy. But like Chawamushi not having that set, and that's one of those like dishes, it's a very flanish kind of texture, and our neighborhood place we love, Tsubaki, does one, and I really like it. But it's sort of like, because there aren't a lot of spices, like you have to nail the texture, it is a mess. Like I am convinced he would have gone home had the quick fire been a challenge, or an elimination challenge, and that really just sort of surprised me. It was like, okay, it's a time thing, and then to come up with one, and there's nothing worse than sort of bland, dry, cold salmon. Like, you know, like we've had it like at a brunch or something. And it's just like, I was really disappointed because I've had him as an autopilot contestant. I'm not going to have to worry. And he was just kind of not there this week. It was really disappointing. And like looking at next to your top pick, Gabe, it's like, wait, I traded up to pass over Gabe. I don't know, man. Like Gabe's looking kind of. Certainly equal footing, you know, if not better.
I was so excited to hear that Richard didn't like Gabe's dish because I picked up on it when he said it just seemed weird to me. And then Tom said something like, yeah, I hear what
you need more fruit and gravy.
Yeah. Yeah. and it was a counter to what Richard was saying. And I could tell that Richard was like, I'm not so big on that dish. Whereas Amar, he's just licking the plate and Gabe wins. And what it drives home for me is that just because you win a competition does not mean it's unanimous. It's just something that I always just kind of assumed is that the winner of the challenge is someone where every judge or everyone who ate that dish was just like, that was the best dish. But it is interesting to see, you know, Gabe doing this plum with the chicken and pork jus. It didn't wow everybody, but still, I think it was inventive enough is to create like the plum being the protein and not the other way around. I thought that was really creative. And this is the Gabe that I was expecting was just, I think there might be a turn here. I predicted it last week. I thought maybe we'd see Gabe start to take off and he comes in with a top three finish on the quickfire. And then the winning this episode, I really feel good about it. And in our fantasy league, he has the most points right now. He has 19 points in our fantasy league, then Shota at 18. And then we have Avishar at 15. So he wins with Shota in their episode two and then finishes in the top last week. So I'm sitting here and I'm feeling better about my team after this week because I had, you know, of course, Nelson was in the bottom three, but Gabriel finished in the top three with his oysters. And then Jamie Byron and Maria once again finishes in the middle.
Maria in the middle.
And she, you know, she's just coasting right now. She's in the middle there with Byron. And my weekly score, I had 22 points this week and you finished with 10. So the gap is closing. You're still out in front at 61 points to my 58 this season. Are you willing to say that if you were power ranking the order or if you were to redo a draft here, Kevin, that you would have Shota number one, or do you think Gabe moves into the number one spot for you?
No, I still have Shota number one. I think his ceiling is a bit higher. Like, I think he just does stuff that is just completely just overwhelms with its originality a judge. But yeah, I think the gap is much, much more narrow. A contestant that it's funny because I had him ranked fairly low and you picked him fairly high was Nelson. I haven't seen one dish I couldn't live without. I don't understand. Like, I see a lot of the same stuff. I see whenever he tries to veer away from that, I see a chef who just, you can't execute it. I really like the guy, but has he cooked one thing that's been remotely interesting?
No, not doing well so far. And I actually thought, Kevin, that when they did the little vignette, the little segment about him and Oakland, I was like, oh, he's going home today. And that kind of informed my feelings at the end when they were on the chopping block. I thought Nelson was going home because we got a little bit of more of his story in the first couple blocks of the show.
Tom, Last Chance Kitchen is back in full force. Going to be a really interesting loser's bracket, I think, this season. And, you know, we have Brittany versus Sasha as the leadoff undercard. And what did you see in the competition? Do either of these chefs have some staying power?
Oh, Sasha definitely does. She wins Last Chance Kitchen in this episode going against Brittany. Brittany does a chowder with crab and cod with corn and the cob. And then you see Sasha doing a chicken cacciatore with some Calabrian chilies, which I just think of Dante Calabria, who played for UNC back in the day. Anyway, she does this mushroom chicken cacciatore, which Kwame says was the best thing he's tasted all season. And Sasha goes into the competition and wins and survives. And Kevin, I got to say something about Sasha here. She is not just a great chef for Top Chef. She's also really good at TV. She's funny. She's got wit to her. When Tom says something to try to dig at her, she bounces back, and she's really good at Top Chef. And I'm kind of bummed out that she's down here in Last Chance Kitchen, but I'm really excited to see what she does. I think, you know, going against Kiki, I think Sasha has a lot of staying power, not just because of her chef's chops, but also she's figured this out. So Sasha continues. She moves on in Last Chance Kitchen. You're very happy about that because she's on your team. Brittany is eliminated, and, you know, credentialist, I'm sorry, but you look at the two James Beard Award nominees from Brittany. She's going home from the competition, and it didn't work out for her on Top Chef. But yeah, Last Chance Kitchen, still a great, great episode here. And Brittany just saying, it's the kiss of death. She says, I overthink things too much on this show. And it goes to show she goes home. Last Chance Kitchen, Kiki versus Sasha, will recap next week. But Kevin, a really good episode of Top Chef. It was great to talk to Richard Blaise, and I'm really excited to see whether Gabe or Shota separates themselves from the pack going forward.
No, the field is getting more, not less interesting. I'm also very excited about Chris, a top finish elimination. I've always sensed he was the best chef not doing good work in the early going. He clearly has some technique, some skill. I mean, you heard Richard Blaise. There were some Thomas Keller notes there. I'm telling you, man, he's my dark horse right now. He is a guy who's going to stick around and is going to be a force before it's all over. This is my sort of dark horse pick of the week. Tom, final closing thoughts.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about my mom's stroganoff. I don't know about you. Like, what is the Campbell's soup dish that you're thinking about?
The Campbell's soup. You know what? I still love my sort of cream of mushroom green bean casserole with those fried onions on top. That is such an American classic, and it never gets old. I will always reach for that at a picnic.
Awesome,
Tom. We'll talk next week. For Tom Haberstroh, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.